abused its discretion by failing to give the requested definition of scheme of defraud in the jury instructions. Second is whether there were the government failed to show in a substantial effect on interstate commerce in relation to 8 of the health care fraud counts, which resulted in conviction in this case. And third, whether the district court used an erroneous method to calculate the loss for which Dr. Klein was responsible for when it came time to sentence him. First, regarding the scheme to defraud jury instruction. To show that a district court abused its discretion in refusing a requested jury instruction, the defense must show 3 things. The first is that the instruction was legally correct. I don't take the government's brief as disputing that in this case. This definition has appeared in a number of this court's opinions for many years. The second is that the topic matter was not covered in any of the other instructions. And again, I don't take the government as disputing this in its brief. Nothing else in the judge's instructions alerted the jury to this requirement of the reasonable person standard on the part of a victim. So finally, the third point is whether or not the failure to give the requested instruction substantially impeded the defendant's ability to present his defense. And that's what happened in this case. Dr. Klein's primary defense in this case was that the insurers either knew or should have known how he was billing, and he presented substantial evidence on this point. The counts of the indictment in this case begin in early 2001, Your Honor. And prior to that time, in the summer and fall of 2000, Dr. Klein presented evidence that one of the insurers was in fact told and confirmed this in writing that Dr. Klein was providing medicine to his patients in the office and that the patients were then self-injecting at home. And this was 5 to 6 months before any of the specific fraudulent counts of the indictment arose. He also presented evidence that his pattern of billing informed the insurers of this. His pattern of billing was consistent in relation to the provision of medicine. He submitted 3 forms for reimbursement each week. On one form, there'd be a request for reimbursement for an office visit, for a blood draw, tests, and medicine. The other 2 requests for reimbursement would not have requests for reimbursement for an office visit or any physical contact. There wouldn't be a request for a blood draw, for lab tests. It would usually be either.
But isn't that just saying it wasn't false? I mean, how could the jury believe he submitted false invoices if they believed your version of the story, which is he explained to them what he was doing?
The question is, the jury found that the falsehood in these reimbursements that the government focused on was the place of service code on these reimbursements, which for all 3 was the office. Dr. Klein presented testimony that presented an expert biller who testimony was that this was the best he could do under these circumstances. The jury might have found that this was, in fact, presumably in finding conviction, the jury presumably found that these representations were, in fact, false. But the question is whether or not the jury found whether the insurers were reasonable in interpreting these representations to be representations that everything was done in his office,
I'm back to the problem of the instruction that the jury was given was that it was a scheme to deprive another of money, property, or the intangible right of honest services by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises. If the jury believed your version of the story, they could not have said yes to that or guilty under that instruction. So I'm just having trouble as we're trying to understand how this might have affected your client's defense, how it's possible for the jury to believe that he did that and yet he was somehow honest or somehow didn't deceive an honest person or somehow the insurance company just wasn't smart enough or should have been smarter or something of that nature.
Well, the jury could have found, and this is what happened in some of the cases from the 11th Circuit that I cited, not just the one that's, as the government pointed out, since been vacated, SVET, that in those cases there were false representations. But in light of the totality of the circumstances, the victims were not reasonable in relying upon those to come to the conclusions they reached, that, you know, particular home sales were going to increase in value, or that particular life insurance contracts were going to result in certain types of profits. I mean, even if even if Dr. Klein acted with an intent to defraud, as the jury found, it's not a scheme to defraud unless the victim was reasonable in relying upon those. And here the jury was simply not reasonable in relying upon, the insurers were not reasonable in relying upon those as evidence that Dr. Klein was in fact not providing this medicine in his office for self-administration, which is what was happening in all these cases. And here the government also points out, and rightly, that even though the court denied this instruction, Dr. Klein was free to argue this at closing to the jury. But that's not a substitute for a court's instruction. And as this court's held in Burroughs, Dr. Klein was left without a hook when talking to the jury to tie this back in for a reason to acquit him of these counts of conviction. And without that, he was convicted. And accordingly, this court should reverse those and remand for a new trial on those counts of conviction. Regarding the substantial evidence and effect on interstate commerce, this is only raised in relation to 8 of the health care fraud counts of conviction. And these are 8 counts in which the victims were Texas insurers. This court has interpreted similar statutes to the health care fraud statute in this case, 922G and the Hobbs Act. And when interpreting those statutes, which have the affecting commerce language, this court has held that the government has to, in fact, show that there was an effect on interstate commerce. And like any other element, the government has to prove it.
Is there anything in the record that expands on the two Texas insurers' relationship to parents or other corporations within their corporate family so that there is evidence that they are, in fact, connected to interstate commerce?
Not that I'm aware of, and I didn't see that in the government's brief on this point. The one insurance representative testified when she was talking about employment history that she had worked for a different branch. I think it was a Blue Cross Blue Shield in a different state, but there was no indication that it was a transfer as opposed to just a move to a new employer.
Well, on something as gigantic as Blue Shield, is it not even possible to take judicial notice of the interstate nature of it rather than being Blue Shield of Texas being cabined to the borders of Texas?
No, Your Honor. The ownership and relationship of these companies are, to my best knowledge, complex. Off the top of my head, I wouldn't know what relationship Texas Blue Cross Blue Shield has with any of the other entities, whether it's an ownership or working in parallel, whatever it might be. And the government hasn't put that forth. And I would point this court to...
When was this objection raised?
At both the close of the defendant's evidence and at the close of the case, there was a general motion for acquittal, and then the defendant.
Well, I mean, on the victim of the two Texas companies, was there anything raised to object that they were not shown to be in interstate commerce?
No, it was just a general motion for acquittal at the close of the government's case and at the close of trial, in which the defense argued that the government had failed to meet its burden of proof as to all counts, all elements as to all counts. And then
As to these two victims, why aren't we on plain error review?
Because he made, in fact, the general motion for acquittal preserves the specific...
Well, if you make a general motion for acquittal and you say that takes care of any of the details, you'd never have a plain error review of anything.
Well, this court has seen many cases where there was no general motion for acquittal. I mean, oftentimes there's just the specific
You're depending on a general motion for acquittal.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that is what was made in this case. There wasn't.
But then now on appeal, you raise the issue of these two companies could not have been or were not shown to be in interstate commerce, and yet there was no point of that made until appeal, as far as I can tell.
Right. I've narrowed down the objection from what was made at trial. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But there was both a written objection and the oral objection at the close of the defendant's case was general, and then again it was not a written motion, but it was just an oral motion at the close of the trial for, again, on all counts, all elements of all counts that the government had failed to present evidence. And on appeal, I'm choosing just to raise it as to this one element and as to particular counts. The government's...
While you have time, I hope you'll spend some time on the question of the non-disinterested prosecutor on sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, my last point on this will be then that the government's main point to show that there was an effect on interstate commerce for these counts was that the insurers had made intrastate use of the mails. And there was evidence of that at the trial. But again, they have not pointed to any case where merely intrastate use of the channels of commerce has been sufficient to show an effect on interstate commerce. That's been sufficient when the jurisdictional hook is the channels of interstate commerce, like in the federal murder for hire statute. But that's not the jurisdictional hook that was used here. The Congress chose to use something else.
So mail does not affect the United States mail does not affect commerce? Because isn't that the basis for a great many of these criminal fraud statutes is use of the mails? And you're telling us that doesn't work?
Well, again, I'm not, that's why we're not challenging this for the mail fraud counts. I'm only challenging this for the health care fraud counts, because there the actual element Congress put in was affecting commerce.
Affecting commerce. And you're saying the United States mail is sufficient to allow jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause but doesn't affect commerce. Is that your argument?
My argument is that on these particular counts, the government failed to meet its burden of showing that in relation to these counts that there was an effect on interstate commerce. In the mere use, yes, my argument is that for a particular count, the mere use of an intrastate means of communication does not satisfy the government's burden. Congress could have chosen, Congress would have acted permissibly if it chosen a different jurisdictional hook, like using the channels of interstate commerce, like I said, in the murder for hire statute, but that's not the one that was used here. They went to Category 3 of the Lopez, the affecting interstate commerce.
Judge Smith wanted you to address the prosecutor.
I'm sorry. Yes.
And I've taken your time. I apologize to Judge Smith.
Regarding the disinterested prosecutor, what happened here was extraordinary. In both the written objections, well, the whole process is worth noting. In arguing during the pre-sentence investigation, prior to even getting before the judge, the government relied upon a prosecutor from out of district, from Austin, to handle it, presumably because of this perceived conflict. When the probation office came out against the government's encouraged sentencing range, then the prosecutor who handled the trial, who filed a written objection, identifying himself as a victim, arguing that for an enhanced sentence.
He had not participated in the trial at all.
The U.S. attorney who filed the written objection had been the lead counsel at trial for the United States. The only thing he had not participated in is the advocacy before the probation office on the obstruction of justice enhancement.
I still didn't get your answer to my question. Had the putative victim participated in the guilt-innocence trial?
Yes. Yes, he was the government's lead counsel at trial.
And was there any knowledge by the jury about his being a targeted victim?
No, this was just a sentencing issue, Your Honor.
Okay.
When the defense...
And when was the objection to his participating in the sentencing lodged?
At the sentencing hearing. When this prosecutor stood up and started advocating for this enhanced sentence, the defense counsel then raised up and said, this is a problem. He's a victim. He's identifying himself as a victim.
So there was a contemporaneous objection.
Right. The government disputes that, as I'm sure they'll explain, but that's in fact what happened. The lawyer stood up and said, this is a problem. He's a victim.
I was going to ask you, what did the government say? I mean, we can check the record, of course. What did the government say at that point?
The government, they relied upon a distinction that this particular lawyer, the one who's a victim in the lead counsel, had not been introducing new evidence into the sentencing. He was just relying on matters that had been previously disclosed, either the PSR or the evidence. So he didn't dispute that he was a victim. His quote was, certainly I'm a victim. This has never happened to me in 14 years as a prosecutor. But he drew a distinction between making argument on this point as opposed to introducing facts on this point. And then the court, and if may I make one more?
You can go ahead. Yeah, just spend about one more minute on that point if you want to.
Thank you. And my final point was that, and the judge, in fact, recognized this as a potential issue, pressing the government, so why can you continue on this? This may be going up. And so that's when the government, in fact, presented this further explanation.
Is there no distinction between participation in the trial where the jury's aware of it and then just coming in for sentencing before a senior federal district judge as far as the prejudice is concerned?
No, Your Honor, because this isn't like other trial errors, or trial or sentencing errors. And that's why in the Supreme Court's case of Vertan, the Supreme Court held that harmless error analysis wasn't appropriate. Because if it was just a trial error, a district court judge like this could look at what happened and make a ruling on whether or not it was harmless. But the prosecutors have much more authority and discretion and decision-making power than what goes on in front of the judge regarding what enhancements to bring, regarding what plea deals to make, regarding what witnesses, all that kind of stuff happens but without any oversight from the court except in the most extraordinary circumstances. So because the reasoning of the Supreme Court of Vertan was that because so much happens outside of the view of the court and so much of the power is what is this discretionary power of the prosecutor, that when there's a disinterested prosecutor involved, harmless error analysis is not appropriate, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. You. Your initial time has expired, but you've saved your full 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Berry? Why don't you, go ahead and introduce yourself, but why don't you address this last point first while everyone's got it in mind?
Sure. Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Gallagher. The disinterested prosecutor issue?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I'd be delighted to, Your Honor. In response to Judge Wiener's question, yes, sir, Your Honor, this prosecutor was the lead prosecutor for the United States both through the investigation of the case and through prosecution of the case. He participated in every single aspect of the investigation and prosecution of the case. He participated in the preparation of the PSR. The only thing he did not participate in was the discussion with the probation officer concerning whether or not to apply the two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice based on Klein's discussions with El Hawa, McCardo, and Gamboa in the Houston Detention Center.
But there's been no objection to his participation in the trial, presumably because that was not revealed to or known by the jury. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, that is absolutely correct. The record does not affirmatively disclosed that it was never brought out in front of the jury, but I respectfully submit there is no reference in the record at any point during the trial that Klein had conspired to have the prosecutor, the agent.
Well, and in fact, the only objection is to the effect on sentence.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And at the outset, I would argue that at sentencing, the objection was a general objection not to the AUSA Sam Lewis participating in the sentencing, but rather to the timing of AUSA Lewis's motion to apply the two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice.
I guess I'm wondering on this point of sort of whether you make a harmless error analysis, we want to call it that, at the sentencing phase. Mr. Gallagher suggested you can't because there's so much prosecutorial discretion. I understand that when you're talking about the initial charge and there's a lot of different crimes you could charge somebody under and so on and so forth. I guess I'm wondering at the sentencing phase, is there any indication any other AUSA would not have pursued the obstruction of justice enhancement? Because it seems to me our prosecutorial discretion inquiry is limited to one point here. There's no allegation he went wild trying to get anything else out there or making, pursuing some sort of vendetta. So the question is really on this obstruction of justice enhancement. And I guess I'm wondering, do we have any indication in the record one way or the other whether another AUSA in that department would have said, well, forget that, we're not pursuing that enhancement?
As a matter of fact, Your Honor asks a rather excellent question. As a matter of fact, we do. In accordance with office policy and, to the best of my knowledge, general DOJ policy, when a member of the district is involved in the district is recused and the case is referred to an adjacent district. In this case, since the plot involved, among other things, a plan to kill Sam Lewis and the FBI, the lead case agent, The case was referred to the Western District of Texas for potential prosecution either for attempting to kill a federal employee or threatening to kill a federal employee. As Mr. Gallagher correctly notes in a footnote, Dr. Klein was eventually indicted for and pled guilty to threatening to kill the AUSA and the case agent, Jamie Poteet. In this case, and I believe the PSR sets this out, in this case, the separate prosecution of Dr. Klein was referred to AUSA Sharon Pierce in the Austin Division of the Western District of Texas. She was sworn in as a special AUSA in our district. I believe the PSR is clear in that Ms. Pierce specifically advocated in favor of the two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice. Going back to, in answer to your question, referring back to what Judge Wiener said, I would respectfully submit that Sam Lewis was not arguing for personal consideration. He frequently refers to himself in the third person. He was simply arguing to the district court that the court should interpret the set of facts set out in 20 full paragraphs in the PSR differently from the manner in which the probation officer resolved those facts. In essence, she sets out the facts concerning Klein's discussion with his cellmates and the others in the federal detention center and the creation of the bank account and the transfer of $250,000 and the letter that she received from defense counsel, and then focuses in on a single statement by Dr. Klein in one of his two meetings with an undercover FBI agent that the prosecutor and the case agent shouldn't be touched. And from that concludes that he's renounced his intent to have them both killed, although earlier.
No, I understand that. I guess what I'm wondering is, in terms of our analysis, are you saying that in essence we would be taking a hollow course were we to simply reverse and remand for resentencing with a different AUSA who would just get up and make the same exact argument with presumably the same result? Is that what you're essentially arguing, that it really didn't make a difference that it was Mr. Lewis making the argument because any other AUSA in that office would have argued for the obstruction of justice and perhaps more forcefully about how one of their own brothers, if you will, was a victim?
Well, that's exactly the argument that I'm making, although more articulately than I'm making it, of course. I submit that Ms. Pierce probably would have been substantially more vocal than Mr. Lewis was for precisely that reason. In an effort to avoid the appearance of impropriety, Mr. Lewis attempted to keep the argument in the third-person realm. Ms. Pierce, of course, would have been free to make it in the first-person realm. He, Ira Klein, literally tried to kill one of my colleagues. Mm-hmm.
Is there a particular reason why Ms. Pierce did not continue with the advocacy by appearing at sentencing?
As Mr. Lewis explained at sentencing, Your Honor, Ms. Pierce reviewed the PSR and concluded that she didn't have standing to participate in the sentencing of Dr. Klein. She was appointed as a special AUSA, in essence, just to handle any potential prosecution arising from the threats to kill the AUSA and the case agent.
But two different cases is what you're saying. She's only sworn in.
They're two different cases, and in essence, to avoid, as Judge Haynes said, as all of you have said, the rather substantial implication of a not disinterested prosecutor were we to indict the case in the Southern District with an AUSA from the same office where Sam Lewis works, handling the prosecution for threatening to kill Sam Lewis.
Well, stripped of all of that, what we've got before us is a PSR that did not recommend this enhancement.
Yes, sir.
An AUSA who had been the potential target or the actual target of a non-completed crime, and that same USA arguing to a judge who, sua sponte, or based on that argument but against the PSR, does the enhancement. Now, that facially there is harm and prejudice. How do we do that if we can't do it with harmless error?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully argue that if the court adopts a harmless error analysis, Mr. Klein started at a total offense level 31, criminal history category 1. The range was 108 to 135. After Judge Hittner applied the two-level enhancement, the advisory guideline range would have increased to 135 months to 168 months. The sentence that Judge Hittner imposed would have been the top end of the guideline range without the enhancement, or the bottom end of the guideline range with the enhancement.
But he verbalized that he was doing the enhancement based on obstruction of justice for plotting to kill Lewis and others.
Lewis and the FBI agent, yes, sir, Your Honor, that is correct. Again, I would respectfully submit that Mr. Lewis didn't argue anything that was outside the record. He didn't make reference to any facts or circumstances not contained within the PSR. The sole impetus of his advocacy was a different interpretation of those facts than that arrived at by the probation officer.
Mr. Berry, I don't want to interrupt if Judge Wiener has any more, but I'm concerned about getting to the loss issue because we haven't heard from you on that. And so, Judge Wiener, if I've interrupted you, I apologize. I wanted to make sure you got to this question of the calculation of the loss because it seems to me that your argument is, look, if you're going to go around illegally dispensing medications as a doctor, then you just get what you're coming for, and you're going to be held responsible for the whole amount. And it appears that the argument for Dr. Klein is, look, you have to net out the value, and there clearly was value here. Nobody's disputing that some medications were administered, that, in fact, these patients got some treatment that otherwise their carriers would have had to pay for with a doctor who wasn't engaging in these other, you know, questionable activities. So I guess what I'm wondering is it seems like we have a clear polars here, and what is your answer to the sentencing guideline that essentially says you're supposed to net this out?
Well, Your Honor, in a sense, it was netted out in that McWhorter's testimony shows his loss calculations, which ultimately proved to be the loss calculations for the PSR, his loss calculations denied Klein credit for services performed on the usually 2 days a week when the patients didn't come. The crux of the scheme was you come on one day, Monday, you get an injection,
right.
You get two syringes.
Right,
you take,
I gather that.
He said, I don't give you any credit for Wednesday and Friday.
But didn't he actually give them the syringes and that's part of the charge? So, I mean, as I understand the Klein's argument, it is that while he didn't actually administer the shot, there was, in fact, a shot provided that would have cost somebody something. And so these carriers did get something. So if the shot was, you know, billed at $10 and it would have cost $8 somewhere else, then the loss, according to Klein, is 2, not 10. And you're saying it's 10 because he had no business dispensing this shot in the first place, the way he did it, by giving it as self-administered and not sending him to a pharmacy and so on and so forth. So I'm trying to focus on, is that the crux of it? And if so, what is the argument for not netting out?
It's not quite the crux of
it,
Your Honor. In essence, he was unbundling the kits. The kits were designed to be sold as kits. Depending on which witness you listen to, he was buying the kits for approximately $700 apiece. He took apart the injectable interferon and the ribavirin tablets and sold those and then rebilled that to the insurance companies at approximately $4,200 per kit. So he did get credit for whatever drugs he dispensed on Monday. And the crux
did
of that
did he not get credit, though, for the what he paid for the kit, the whole cost of the kit?
He did not get credit for what he paid for the whole cost of the kit. But what he was billing for the drugs he dispensed on Monday was so grossly exaggerated that he was, in essence, being recompensated for the entire cost of the kit.
But he was disallowed the entire amount, was he not, that he charged for this disassembled kit?
No, sir, Your Honor. He was allowed what he billed for the part of the kit. The kit would have contained enough interferon for 3 injections and enough ribavirin for a 7-day treatment. He was allowed credit for the part of the kit, for lack of a better term, roughly a third of the kit that he would have dispensed on Monday. In essence, he would be disallowed credit for the part that they would have taken home to use Wednesday and Friday.
You're failing, as Judge Haynes implied, you're failing to distinguish between the service he didn't give on the other 2 days and the actual drugs that he gave them Monday to use and they used on those days.
Well, I would respectfully disagree in this regard. The whole point of health care fraud is, as the representatives from Blue Cross and Cigna and United said, the insurance companies negotiate a bulk rate price with the drug manufacturer, in this case, Shearing Plough. I unfortunately did not find in the record any reference to what that bulk right price would have been. But everyone covered by Blue Cross would pay exactly the same price for a Rebatron kit. There's no showing in the record whether it would have been $700 or $60 or $1,200. The point is, the purchase price that Dr. Klein wanted to be reimbursed for, the purchase price that Dr. Klein was paying was approximately $700. And then he's billing the components back at a factor of roughly six times what he paid for.
But shouldn't he net out that $700? I mean, if he charged 1,000 times what he was actually paying, the question is still, can he net out that $700?
Well, and the point I'm trying inarticulately to make is he netted it out and then some. He billed out $4,200 for what he paid $700.
But he was only given he was only given credit for one third of that on your example, because.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. He was given credit for one third of that, which would be $1,400, which would mean.
No, I'm talking about one third of the $700. You said.
No, sir. He was billing out the components.
I understand that, okay. But he paid $700 for all of the components.
Yes, sir.
He was disallowed everything in excess of $700, plus two thirds of the $700 was disallowed because that's what they gave themselves on the next 2 days.
No, sir, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think he was allowed a third of the $4,200 that he billed for the components of each kit.
Okay, if we can't figure out what McWhorter did, then which way does that cut? Because it seems like this was a very convoluted way he went about this. Well, I'll kind of sort of guess at what was an office visit and whatever. And I guess I'm wondering, when we're talking about sentencing somebody in a criminal case, can we do it in a manner that you don't even know what he was credited for and what he wasn't credited for and what he was charged with and what he wasn't charged with? Which way does that cut in our review as an appellate court if no one can figure out what McWhorter did, or if what he did was somewhat haphazard and, well, if there's a progress note or there's not or this or that? Which way does that cut? Does confusion cut, I guess?
Well, Your Honor, as the guidelines say, the loss value should be as exact as possible, but it only need be approximate. In this case, it was $10.5 million above the amount necessary to apply the 20-level enhancement that Dr. Klein received. In the second place, and something I should have stressed at the start, this ignores the fact that he was violating both the regulations applicable to doctors practicing medicine in Texas and violating state law.
Well, that was my original question. I really thought we've kind of gone off on really the math, and I thought your whole premise was, look, I don't care whether they got value or not. This guy is acting in violation of Texas law. He didn't get credit for anything.
Well, that
the whole thing's a fraud. I mean, I thought that was your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That was my primary argument. To allow him credit for the drugs that the victims took home would be to reward him for violating state law, and I can't conceive
that. And what's
that
your best authority for the proposition that that's how we apply this? I understand the general principle of not letting people profit from crime, but what is your best citation that we can look to on this point you just made?
Jones and Medina, which are discussed and cited both in my brief and in Dr. Klein's brief.
Okay.
And when they're discussing the value added, and Jones was a healthcare fraud case from Louisiana, and the question was whether or not the two individuals actually provided consulting fees and whether or not that was disclosed. Here, the insurance companies unequivocally stated they would not have paid for drugs that Dr. Klein was giving the patients to take home for the simple reason that they knew that he'd be violating state law. And because they had negotiated contracts with the drug manufacturer, Shearing Plough, to provide those drugs at pharmacies.
And where was Shearing Plough located? Where is their home? Is there any evidence on that? I'm getting back to interstate commerce. And
if you
we're on this topic.
Government exhibits, I believe it's the 5H series. They have offices across the country. The exhibits in the 5H series shows that the drugs were ordered originally from Reno, Nevada, and at a later point in time from New Jersey.
By the Blue Cross and Cigna entities that Mr. Gallagher is challenging as being entrusted?
Well, they were ordered by Dr. Klein.
I know, but the deal that you mentioned that was cut with these manufacturers to have reduced rates, who was that cut with?
That would have been a national deal cut between Cigna, for example, and Shearing Plough
And there's evidence in the record on that.
There is.
And so is that an effect on commerce, if we've got drugs that are being bought by the doctor pursuant to national deal?
To go back to your original questions to Mr. Gallagher, there's abundant effect on interstate commerce. Dr. Klein ordered his drugs. The drugs were all shipped from out of state, originally from Nevada and then from New Jersey.
Yeah, but his point is the health carrier has to affect commerce. And so I'm asking about the deal that the health carrier – I mean, we've been over the mail issue. Oh. But putting aside the mail issue, I'm saying, what about this deal that these health carriers have cut with a national company? Is that a health carrier effect on interstate commerce?
Well, at the outset, I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Gallagher's characterization that the Cigna rep testified that Cigna is a Texas company. She testified that she was in Texas, but she did not testify in the record that Cigna is a Texas company. The Blue Cross representative testified that Blue Cross Texas has reciprocal agreements with other Blue Cross companies so that when someone covered by, say, Blue Cross Louisiana is in Texas and needs medical care, Blue Cross Texas pays for that care, and then there's a reimbursement agreement between Blue Cross Texas and Blue Cross Louisiana. As you said, we've already gone over the mail issue, I think. Also, the Cigna rep, I believe, testified that Cigna processes some 80,000 health care claims a week. That is in the record. And to the extent that Mr. Gallagher chastises me for not having record sites, the record sites are in the summary or in the statement of facts, then I simply didn't repeat those into the argument portion of the brief. Yes, the Cigna rep testified that they had processed approximately 80,000 claims a week. Finally, the Blue Cross Blue Shield rep testified that they received the majority of their HCFA 1500 forms from Dr. Klein and sent payment to Dr. Klein through the mails, of course.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ferry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Gallagher, would you address this question of the loss calculation? One point that Mr. Berry made, if I understood him right, was that the amount that was calculated here was so well in excess of what would have been needed to apply the enhancement anyway, that loss value need be only approximate. So I guess his argument is it really wouldn't have made a difference even if we agreed with your calculation. Could you speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor. And of course, that's right, that the loss calculation need only be approximate in a particular case. But that there's no indication that was the basis for the judge's overruling of the objection in this matter. He argued that he should have been credited for loss. And neither the probation report nor the court gave any indication that, well, yeah, that's right, but you get this enhancement anyway because of these other matters of the sort that Mr. Berry refers to. It was just a simple objection.
But we can look at it, can't we, from the perspective of course, seeing the record and hearing the argument. We can look at it from the perspective of that it really wouldn't have made a difference. Aren't we able to do that?
You could, Your Honor, review it for harmless error, but it's not clear on this record. Mr. Berry talked about the dispensing and billing of these Rebitron kits. That's only a portion of the medicines for which Dr. Klein was held accountable. He was held accountable for vast quantities of I'm surely pronouncing it wrong, an Epitin drug and a Neupogen drug, which were not part of these kits, for which he provided patients to help deal with various symptoms and then build insurers. And those were part of these medicines that were delivered on these other days.
Well, what is it that you are claiming that McWhorter did not give credit for?
He did not give credit. He did not make any attempt to estimate the value of the retail value of the medicines provided by Dr. Klein on the days patients were not in the office.
So if Dr. Klein gave him a week's worth on Monday, and we assumed it's equal Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, then he got credit for one-third, two-thirds, 100%, or zero, which is correct?
On this record, it's, as I pointed out in the brief, the value of those medicines was the substantial part of the charges that he was reimbursed for. His office visits and tests were just a fraction. The medicines were the biggest part, by far, well over 90% of the loss calculation.
And what part did he not get credit for on those under the McWhorter calculation?
He did not get credit. He didn't get credit for anything on the days patients were not in the office. Through the whole course of treatment, he received payment for the days the medicine was delivered in the office, but there's no indication that that was, in fact, it's not clear that that was fraudulent. The healthcare companies, by and large, testified that
If he paid $700 for the kit, keep continuing with that. I know that's not the only thing he gave.
Right.
But if he got credit for the kit that he gave him on Monday, did he get credit for the whole 700 or a third of 700, or how did that work in the McWhorter calculation?
No, he got credited for – he didn't bill it as a kit. He got credited for the particular injections he provided on Monday, which were – I forget the price of the individual injections, but would be at least $700. But, again, that's the retail that's the wholesale cost of the kit.
That's what I wanted to ask. What are we having to net out here under your theory of the world, the retail value on the open market or what it really cost him that these insurance companies had negotiated to get this reduced rate so that they could overall have a lower cost of provision of, you know, care to their patient, to their insureds? You're saying we net out the retail value on the open market, what it would cost at, you know, the pharmacy. And actually, though, these carriers never would have paid that had they had an honest doctor. They never would have paid that because they've cut this deal with the national company to get these medicines at these lower prices.
Right.
And so I don't understand why we would give a retail value that never would have been paid by anybody, no matter how ethically Dr. Klein had performed his practice, if he'd done what he was supposed to do. I don't understand why that would be the loss, that the net that we would apply, the amount that we would subtract from the total loss.
Well, there's a subsidiary question of whether or not, of how to calculate it, and because of the way the judge ruled on the district court, the court never reached that. One argument is that it should only be this agreed-upon rate, what the healthcare providers would have paid had they gone to insurers, and that might be what the judge ultimately would have decided. That's what he should have gotten credit for. But there's another argument that Dr. Klein, in his bills, was always very clear about what medicines were being provided to them. The government's fraud in relation to these was where the service was being provided, not what medicines were being provided. And they reimbursed him for those at certain rates. And so...
But I think it matters what the number is because it goes back to the order of magnitude question that Mr. Berry raised. What is the order of magnitude? Was it a big enough difference? If you were going to reverse and remand for more sentencing on this, is it going to make a difference? And have you shown us that it would? Because we've got to find $10 million of netting that didn't happen for it to make a difference. And you haven't pointed to anything that would suggest it's that big an order of magnitude.
Weitzman, in this case, that the government hasn't shown that it wouldn't, and since the objection is preserved, the burden's upon them. We've showed that the court used an impermissible method of determining loss. And like OLIS, this is very complicated. And there are possible different methods for determining loss, these contracts, the wholesale price, whatever. The district court's in the best position to determine this. But as of now, on this record, the government hasn't shown that the error was harmless, taking into account these different types of medicines, the particular billing practices, the various contracts. They haven't met their burden.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Your case is under submission. Next case for today, Jay Lee.